Good morning, good morning. We are dancing in with Soul Mikasa, Mano Dibango. This is Charlotte Farrell, your own Sister C, right here in the place to be, CJSF Radio 90.1, with your Friday
Good morning,
speak
good
up
morning.
Show.
This is your own Sister C, Charlotte Farrell, here at the place to be, CJSF.ca 90.1 in Burnaby. Today, I'm a little tearful. Today we're going to be honoring the life and legacy of Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., a man whose vision for justice and equality continues to inspire us. I'm remembering the day, April 4th, 1968, when Dr. King was assassinated. I was in the office of the Black Students Association. We had been following the news about the strikes, following the news of what was happening in the country, and just meeting to ensure or encourage the neighborhood to be supportive of different things, workshops and stuff that were going to be happening. And then it came across that Dr. King had been shot, and I was screaming, crying, opening the windows out on the campus. You know, we had people going out as teams to discourage any violence, but to just give comfort, because people were just hugging each other or comforting each other, coming out of stores, coming out. And so what Jesse, the public affairs director at the station, and I are going to do today is share some excerpts from some of Dr. King's most powerful speeches, reminding us of the enduring relevance of his message and the work that still lies ahead, and the ways that we might need to picture how can we work together better with neighbors, how can we work together to have a system, a stream that's not pop news or things that drive people up into fighting each other or worse. But how can we, what can we do with the person that lives next to us at our religious center, at the university here, to take time to talk about what's happening today rather than just saying, oh, this is so bad or that's so bad or did you know they're blocking this? But to really go through and discuss what can you do, what can we do together to make this a more peaceful place and to arrive at the kind of legacy that Dr. King lost his life working for. We have four stages, segments. We're going to be less of hearing me talk and more of letting you hear and feel the sentiments that not only Dr. King had, but the things that students, teachers, people of all walks of life let you hear what they were discussing and what he was anchoring by bringing people together in a nonviolent way to show what can be achieved.
And before we get into the four segments, I believe you wanted to kick things off with a piece of music.
Sweet Honey and the Rock. Well, could talk about music that you'll be hearing today, but one of the persons who frequently traveled with Dr. King or was set up to present music at a concert the night before he was speaking was Mahalia Jackson. So you will be hearing one of her songs there. And then another variety of styles, the call and response songs. So we will be sharing that with you so you'll get the feeling of the time. And you will also see how people like Aretha Franklin honored him in not only being a jazz artist, but also in being a religious artist.
Great. So we'll hear now from Mahalia Jackson, and we'll be right back for the first segment.
Okay, in our first segment, I'm going to share a little bit of the early life and influences of Dr. King. Dr. King was born on January 15, 1929, in Atlanta, Georgia. His early life was shaped by his father, the teachings of his father, and the profound injustice of segregation. Let's listen to an excerpt from his speech at the Montgomery bus boycott in 1955, where he first emerged as a leader
in the fight for civil rights. In a way that this is alive for me, I was in elementary school then, and we saw on the TV these people being beaten up, and then we heard Dr. King's voice, and I was wondering and thinking, how is that going to affect us? What can we do? And I told my parents I wanted to be involved in the boycott, and she said no, I was too small, too young. But that anchored a point to where by 1964, when I graduated from high school, I was a part of a student action group. We to the credit of the Southern Christian Leadership organization, they came to churches and they went to schools and they showed people how to shield themselves if they were hit, how to lock arms and sit down. And the feeling of love, because all across the country, when people were going to demonstrate, there were people who went before, met at churches, community centers, lodges, bowling alleys, and taught people what the movement was about, how it was related to their city. And so without further ado talking, because it's emotional to think
of course.
That now what is really hurtful is thinking of all the work that was done by Dr. King and other people, all the marches we were in, all the chicken we ate, but that it could be right now those things that we thought were anchored by working together, praying together, marching together, they're being uprooted. So I encourage you to really think, listen, interact, get to know the people that you're in school with, the library with, other places of things that you can do, like having a discussion with the mayor, what you can do to preserve democracy and what you can do to preserve nonviolence as a means of bringing about change.
And obviously, witnessing from afar the Montgomery bus boycott really left a strong impression on you and perhaps set you on this path of civil organizing and activism. So now let's give our listeners a chance to hear an excerpt from Dr. King's speech,
"The Birth of a New
Nation."
"You remember, it started in America in 1619. There was a big scramble for power in Africa. With the growth of the slave trade that came into Africa, into the Gold Coast in particular, not only the Portuguese, but also the Swedes and the Danes and the Dutch and the British. And all of these nations competed with each other to win the power of the Gold Coast so that they could exploit these people for commercial reasons and sell them into slavery. And finally, in 1850, Britain won out and she gained possession of the total territorial expansion of the Gold Coast. And from 1850 to 1957, March 6th, the Gold Coast was a colony of the British Empire. And as a colony, she suffered all of the injustices, all of the exploitation, all of the humiliation that comes as a result of colonialism. But like all slavery, like all domination, like all exploitation, came to the point that the people got tired of it. That seems to be the long story of history. There seems to be a throbbing desire. There seems to be an internal desire for freedom within the soul of every man. And it's there. It might not break forth in the beginning, but eventually it breaks out. For men realize that freedom is something basic. To rob a man of his freedom is to take from him the essential basis of his manhood. To take from him his freedom is to rob him of something of God's image. Paraphrase the words of Shakespeare's Othello, "Who steals my purse steals trash. 'Tis something nothing, 'twas mine, 'tis his, has been the slave of thousands. But he who filches from me my freedom robs me of that which not enriches him, but makes me poor indeed. That is something in the soul that cries out for freedom. That is something deep down within the very soul of man. That reaches out for Canaan. Men cannot be satisfied with Egypt. They try to adjust to it for a while. Many men have vested interests in Egypt. They are slow to leave. Egypt makes it profitable to them. Some people profit by Egypt. But the vast majority of their masses of people never profit by Egypt. And they are never content with it. And eventually they rise up and begin to cry out for Canaan's land. And so these people got tired. It had a long history. As far back as 1844, the chiefs themselves of the Gold Coast rose up and came together and revolted against the British Empire and the other powers that were in existence at that time dominating the Gold Coast. They revolted, saying that they wanted to govern themselves. But these powers clamped down on them, and the British said that we will not let you go.
That was an excerpt of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s speech, The Birth of a New Nation, from the Montgomery bus boycott in 1955, here on Suluau, Speak Up, Listen Up, Act Upon. I'm Jesse, and I'm here, as always, with Sista C.
And what we want you to do is think about the name Suluau means my guest and I speak up so you can listen up and act upon what you've heard. The second segment that we're doing today is the Civil Rights Movement. Dr. King's leadership during the Civil Rights Movement was pivotal. His ability to articulate the dreams and struggles of African Americans resonated deeply with people across the nation. Now we're going to hear a powerful excerpt from his I Have a Dream speech delivered during the March on Washington in 1963, 1 year before I graduated from high school. And at a time, the summertime, some students, older students who had graduated, were excitedly talking about going to Washington and being a part of that march.
Charlotte, what was your experience of hearing this speech or hearing about it in the moment as a high school student?
Well, there was a lot of energy in the house because as the TV was playing, when they played the I Have a Dream speech, and I saw, oh, some teenagers went. And, you know, my parents reminded me I was not a teenager yet, and that right there in Kansas City, I could take part. But to see so many people, I felt encouraged because when I was in fifth and sixth grade, we were seeing people being beaten, students, kids, having to have the National Guard or other military walk with them into schools as the schools were educated. I was really excited, and I was thinking, oh, if they do that next year, maybe I'll be able to go to Washington. But I think it's this thing that we have right here, radio. I can't encourage more people to listen because on a day when I'm dressing and I just have my phone on, the platform pops up news. Now there's something when I turn on my phone that's saying news for you. And it's curated sound bites. So with radio, we're not giving you sound bites. What we're doing today is both showing our human reactions and emotions, but also saying this is the college and community radio station gives people from all kinds of organizations like Megaphone, other street papers, other papers that you might find to really read and what is going on. Get to know your neighbors, because if you just listen to the mainstream or the pop news, you will get a tone of stuff that is more toward a particular class of people, or it's just not guts news. And so I loved the experience of being at home with people gathered around and neighbors coming over to listen to something that was happening on the radio. It's something that I really hope we inspire and encourage and see people doing here.
And obviously the I Have a Dream speech is famous, right? And yes. It is one of those moments in history. At the time, did you have any sense of the import of that moment, of him delivering the speech?
Well, with the cameras, when we saw the thousands of people there, first is, wow, I didn't know so many people came. I didn't know so many different organizations. I was really excited because we talk about representation. There was representation from unions, from college students, from just so many levels and parts of the community. There were people beyond Black people being there. And so just feeling, people don't see this thing about democracy, or the people don't see the importance of having a dream like Dr. King's being realized. It just made me feel happy that, you know, it's not just us. There are other people who believe in this, and there are other people who are supporting what was in the speech. And then I was also just amazed that where most people spoke 5 minutes, that he was bold enough to speak for over 15 minutes. And so it made me want to speak up. I speak up about things. Sometimes, Jesse, do I speak up about things?
Oh, once a week, I'd say at least. Great. Well, we've teased it enough, I suppose. Let's get into an excerpt of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s speech, I Have a Dream.
Knowing that somehow this situation can and will be changed, let us not wallow in the valley of despair. I say to you today, my friend, so even though we face the difficulties of today and tomorrow, I still have a dream. Yes. It is a dream deeply rooted in the American dream. Yes. I have a dream that one day, yes, this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. Yes. I have a dream that one day on the red hills of Georgia, the sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood. I have a dream that one day even the state of Mississippi, a state sweltering with the heat of injustice, sweltering with the heat of oppression, will be transformed into an oasis of freedom and justice. I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today. I have a dream that one day, down in Alabama with its vicious racists, with its governor having his lips dripping with the words of interposition and nullification, one day right there in Alabama, little black boys and black girls will be able to join hands with little white boys and white girls as sisters and brothers. I have a dream today. I have a dream that one day every valley shall be exalted, and every hill and mountain shall be made low. The rough places will be made plain, and the crooked places will be made straight. And the glory of the Lord shall be revealed, and all flesh shall see it together. This is our hope. This is the faith that I go back to the South with. With this faith, we will be able to hew out of the mountain of despair a stone of hope. With this faith, we will be able to transform the jangling discords of our nation into a beautiful symphony of brotherhood. With this faith, we will be able to work together, to pray together, to struggle together, to go to jail together, to stand up for freedom together, knowing that we will be free one day. This will be the day when all of God's children will be able to sing with new meaning, "My country, tears of thee. Sweet land of liberty, of thee I sing. Land where my fathers died, land of the pilgrim's pride. From every mountainside, let freedom ring. And if America is to be a great nation, this must become true. And so let freedom ring. From the prodigious hilltops of New Hampshire, let freedom ring. From the mighty mountains of New York, let freedom ring. From the heightening Alleghenies of Pennsylvania, let freedom ring. From the snow-capped Rockies of Colorado, let freedom ring. From the curvaceous slopes of California. But not only that, let freedom ring from Stone Mountain of Georgia. Let freedom ring from Lookout Mountain of Tennessee. Let freedom ring from every hill and molehill of Mississippi, from every mountainside. Let freedom ring, and when this happens, when we allow freedom ring, when we let it ring from every village and every hamlet, from every state and every city, we will be able to speed up that day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, "Free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last."
Welcome back to the Sue Lu-Lau Show, where Charlotte and her guest, that's me, Jesse, speak up so you, the listener, can listen up and act upon what you've heard here on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We just heard an excerpt of probably one of the most famous speeches of all time, certainly the most famous by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., who delivered the speech during the March on Washington in 1963. We are here today paying tribute to the memory of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. on the anniversary of his tragic assassination, April 4th.
Our third segment is advocacy for nonviolence. Dr. King's commitment to nonviolence was a cornerstone of his philosophy. In a speech at Stanford University in 1967, he spoke about the challenges facing America and the need for a new vision. Let's listen to a portion of that powerful speech.
The speech we're going to hear is called The Other America. And after that, Charlotte, I think we can take a musical break. Then we'll be back with segment four.
Yes.
So I want to use as a title for my lecture tonight, The Other America. And I use this title because there are literally two Americas. Every city in our country has this kind of dualism, this schizophrenia, split at so many points. And so every city ends up being two cities rather than one. There are two Americas. One America is beautiful for situation. In this America, millions of people have the milk of prosperity and the honey of equality flowing before them. This America is the habitat of millions of people who have food and material necessities for their bodies, culture and education for their minds, freedom and human dignity for their spirits. In this America, children grow up in the sunlight of opportunity.
But that is another America. And this other America has a daily ugliness about it that transforms the buoyancy of hope into the fatigue of despair. In this other America, thousands and thousands of people, men in particular, walk the streets in search for jobs that do not exist. In this other America, millions of people are forced to live in vermin-filled, depressing housing conditions where they do not have the privilege of having wall-to-wall carpet, but all too often they end up with wall-to-wall rats and roaches. Almost 40% of the Negro families of America live in substandard housing conditions. In this other America, thousands of young people are deprived of an opportunity to get an adequate education. Every year, thousands finish high school reading at a seventh, eighth, and sometimes ninth grade level. Not because they're dumb, not because they don't have the native intelligence, but because the schools are so inadequate. So overcrowded, so devoid of quality, so segregated, if you will, that the best in these minds can never come out. Probably the most critical problem in the other America is the economic problem. There are so many people in the other America who can never make ends meet because their incomes are far too low if they have incomes, and their jobs are so devoid of quality. And so in this other America, unemployment is a reality, and underemployment is a reality.
Sometimes people think that old things are passé. I feel that the commitment Dr. King had and the way that he enthusiastically spoke and taught about nonviolence to every level of society, people who go to church, people go to mosque, people who don't go to church but might be at a spirituality center, people, even the people who spat at him or the people who tried to nudge him into being violent, to throwing back a punch or hitting somebody because they spat at him or on him. He was a cornerstone of encouraging people to be nonviolent. And there was, over the years that the civil rights movement was growing and spreading, not only across America, but across the world, it gives us now something to know that these challenges need a new vision, a vision not of just black people, brown people, but a vision of people of every hue, people of every discipline, people of every heart space to see that it's time to not just be in isolation, see that it's not time to just get pop news or sound bites about where someone is being shot, but to really bring people into the conversations that are being held about making schools less violent for children, enabling children to write poems, write songs, write to adults in their community. There was a bus ride inspired by the civil rights bus rides where teenagers from a school that had had the largest number of kids massacred went across the country by buses, and some by plane, asking people to sign up to endorse for active shooter training, to sign up not only for the training for active shooters, but to enable people to do the kinds of things that prevent a person from going to buy a gun because they feel so angry about being ignored. But to just have a program, an organized program across the country to reduce Well, I'm not going to go into the whole thing about gun laws, but just to really have students who were bold enough to model the bus campaigns against nonviolence, students who were bold enough to organize bus and plane trips to cities to discuss and encourage people to change the gun laws in America and other places.
I think there's two threads there, and there's, you know, nonviolence as a philosophy, both as sort of a way of life, but also as a vehicle for change by refusing to engage in violence and making that your worldview and the way that you move through the world. That's a great way to make the world better for everyone. If everyone were to choose nonviolence and focus on nonviolence as the paradigm through which they work, but also organized nonviolence.
Yes.
And the power of the message that nonviolence sends, that you are willing to do everything, including not hurting the people who oppose you, in order to achieve what you believe is right. And to have such firm conviction in what you are doing and what you believe that you don't need to resort to violence to achieve it, because you are confident that it is the right thing. And if you continue to present it as the right thing, eventually people will recognize that, right?
Yes. And the power, hearing and seeing youth, the bus rides that were organized by teenagers for climate change, they didn't go through all of the permitting and so forth. They said, we're going to be there at 1 o'clock, and, you know, they were there. So I think some parents might have been fearful of having their child out of school and taking part in a march, but that was, to me, a connection to the kind of ways that parents connected with their kids who, at elementary school, college, in other places, took the days off, or took the week off to take part in learning how to be specific techniques of not being violent, specific techniques of getting signatures. So I just think that that's a good model, something for us to talk about rather than pop news, 5 minutes, this
sure.
door has broken into whatever.
Yeah, and reinforcing the importance and value of organizing.
Yes.
And the importance of community to organizing and of organizing to community, right? Where, as you're saying, by, you know, taking kids out of school and giving them training on how to participate in democracy, how to enact change in society, you're underlining that those are valuable skills. Those are valuable abilities to have, and there's value to be had by bringing that to society. So I endorse what you're saying there for sure.
Right, and it's so important now that so many things are changing, and we have to hold on to our democracy. And so I was going to say one other thing that was different. When the Southern Christian Leadership Group went to cities and they were going to close a bowling alley, take some kind of action, they also had a place in the church auditorium or somewhere where they taught you how to fall, how to join arms, and how to cover and protect your face and neck. And so where some people would say, oh, I don't want you to go down there and be learning that stuff because you could get killed, there were hundreds of people who did not get healed, thousands of people who did not get killed because, or hurt badly because they had been taught holding arm to arm, putting your face and knees down. There's something that you feel from the energy of that person. And so it's not something people today listening to their devices are listening to anything but that. So I'm just saying this is something in Vancouver that's very doable. We have a lot of festivals and a lot of places. We have places where we encourage people for songs. We're going to be listening to some more songs. Somebody said, please let her get on to the songs. But I think another important thing that people don't know about college and community radio and this radio station, CJSF.ca, that there's an open door policy where people who've written a song, people who have made music and want a chance to have it heard, can bring it. Tell us briefly about that, because that's an element of democracy that some people think, oh, it won't work. But just can you briefly say how people, if you've got your freedom song or their love song, and you want a chance to have it played?
Sure. You can get in touch with our music director, Connor. His email address is cjsfmusc@sfu.ca, cjsfmusc, music without the I, at cjsf.ca. There's also a form on our website, cjsf.ca, that you can fill out and submit your music through there, and then it'll get processed by our music processing team. And you can also reach out directly to hosts of programs. A lot of their contact information is at cjsf.ca if they want that to be public. Or you can reach out to me if you're interested in getting some music on the talk program, cjsfpa@sfu.ca, cjsfpa@sfu.ca. And on that, let's get to some music, huh?
Yes.
Cool.
Marching up to freedom land. Ain't gonna let no.
This is Charlotte Farrell, your own Sister C, here at CJSF.ca, the place to be. Today, we are doing a special tribute to the life and legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in memorial of his death on April 4, 1968. This segment is on legacy and reflection. Okay, as we reflect on Dr. King's legacy, we have to remember his final speech delivered on April 3, 1968, the night before his brutal assassination. In I've Been to the Mountaintop, people whispered to each other, felt something different as he died when he concluded that speech. He spoke, however, of hope and resilience. Let's listen to an excerpt from this poignant address.
Let us rise up tonight with a greater readiness. Let us stand with a greater determination. And let us move on in these powerful days. These days of challenge to make America what it ought to be. We have an opportunity to make America a better nation. And I want to thank God once more for allowing me to be here with you. You know, several years ago, I was in New York City autographing the first book that I had written. While sitting there autographing books, a demented black woman came up. The only question I heard from her was, "Are you Martin Luther King?" And I was looking down writing and I said, "Yes." And the next minute I felt something beating on my chest. Before I knew it, I had been stabbed by this demented woman. I was rushed to Harlem Hospital. It was a dark Saturday afternoon. That blade had gone through, and the x-rays revealed that the tip of the blade was on the edge of my aorta, the main artery. And once that's punctured, you're drowned in your own blood. That's the end of you. It came out in the New York Times the next morning that if I had merely sneezed, I would have died. Well, about 4 days later, they allowed me, after the operation, after my chest had been opened and the blade had been taken out, to move around in the wheelchair in the hospital. They allowed me to read some of the mail that came in, and from all over the states and the world, kind letters came in. I read a few, but one of them I will never forget. I had received one from the president and the vice president. I've forgotten what those telegrams said. I'd received a visit and a letter from the governor of New York, but I've forgotten what that letter said. But there was another letter that came from a little girl, a young girl, who was a student at the White Plains High School. And I looked at that letter, and I'll never forget it. It said simply, "Dear Dr. King, I am a ninth grade student at the White Plains High School." She said, "While it should not matter, I would like to mention that I'm a white girl. I read in the paper of your misfortune and of your suffering. And I read that if you had sneezed, you would have died. And I'm simply writing you to say that I'm so happy that you didn't sneeze. And I want to say tonight, that I too am happy that I didn't sneeze, because if I had sneezed, I wouldn't have been around here in 1960 when students all over the South started sitting in at lunch counters. And I knew that as they were sitting in, they were really standing up for the best in the American dream, and taken the whole nation back to those great wells of democracy which were dug deep by the founding fathers in the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. If I had sneezed, I wouldn't have been around here in 1961 when we decided to take a ride for freedom and ended segregation in interstate travel. If I had sneezed, I wouldn't have been around here in 1962 when Negroes in Albany, Georgia decided to straighten their backs up. And whenever men and women straighten their backs up, they are going somewhere, because a man can't ride your back unless it is bent. If I had sneezed, if I had sneezed, I wouldn't have been here in 1963. And the black people of Birmingham, Alabama, aroused the conscience of this nation and brought into being the Civil Rights Bill. If I had sneezed, I wouldn't have had a chance later that year in August to try to tell America about a dream that I had had. If I had sneezed, I wouldn't have been down in Selma, Alabama to see the great movement there. If I had sneezed, I wouldn't have been in Memphis to see a community rally around those brothers and sisters who are suffering. I'm so happy that I didn't sneeze. And they were telling me, now it doesn't matter now. It really doesn't matter what happens now. I left Atlanta this morning, and as we got started on the plane, there were six of us. The pilot said over the public address system, "We are sorry for the delay, but we have Dr. Martin Luther King on the plane, and to be sure that all of the bags were checked, and to be sure that nothing would be wrong on the plane, we had to check out everything carefully, and we've had the plane protected and guarded all night." And then I got into Memphis, and some began to say the threats, or talk about the threats that were out, or what would happen to me from some of our sick white brothers. Well, I don't know what will happen now. We've got some difficult days ahead. But it really doesn't matter with me now, because I've been to the mountaintop. I don't mind. Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And he's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over, and I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.
That was an excerpt of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s final speech, "I've Been to the Mountaintop," delivered on April 3rd, 1968, the night before his tragic assassination. Obviously, heart-wrenching. You spoke earlier at the beginning of the episode, Charlotte, about hearing of his assassination and the reaction on campus and the reaction of people generally. Obviously, the terrible news to receive, and I can't even really put myself into that space. It's so sort of far removed from my own experience. But, you know, I don't want to necessarily focus on the tragedy of it all. Despite, and maybe in some part because of his assassination, Martin Luther King Jr. continued to be this enormous figure and symbol of hope and change and civil rights generally. For you, in on that day, in the following weeks, months, how did you stay hopeful? Because I feel like we're not in exactly the same space right now, but there's a lot of fear about the, you know, the way the world is going, whether it's climate change, whether it's the same sort of civil rights for various groups. How did you move forward?
Well, first, from that particular night, it was... I guess the word that sticks in my mind is bedlam, because walking from the Black Student Association office, which was in one of the buildings on campus at Wayne State University, people were just breaking out crying. You could see people along the sidewalk, some crying, and then you could hear windows breaking some places. So there was a tear between, oh, we got to heal so people don't, you know, just tear down or be in such despair. And, you know, what's going to happen? It's just millions of questions going through our heads as we were going through trying to give comfort or give directions, you know, to people to go home, listening for other pastors and community groups were firstly urging people not to riot, because riots were breaking out in some cities, so it was a scary time. And I think that just that there was such a layering in from Dr. King to keep going, because when he said, I may not be there with you, but I'll be there, you know, all the same, that it made me listen more, because one of the organizations, there was a Black student organization nationally that was at the table. I think there were enough things that had been put in place that there were people at the table from all different organizations, the Nation of Islam. Just, I felt sad, really terribly sad, but also hopeful that such a system had been set up for recognizing all these different organizations, that they would continue to meet and come up with strategies, which did happen.
And sometimes it does take, in all sorts of ways, sometimes it takes tragedy to bring people together or to bring organizations together in that way. But certainly, as you're saying, a huge thrust of the work that Dr. King did was bringing all these disparate groups together and uniting around this core idea, this core value of civil rights and fundamental human rights.
Right. And nonviolence, you know, that we live in such an eye for an eye society, but that listening post, I think that one of the things as a speaker, a writer, I look for ways to engage children, because I think of, because people involved me as a child or other teenagers as I was older, to make sure the things that we're doing to deal with the strikes, deal with so many things that are happening around us, to keep children in the conversation and to realize that children speaking out, doing their poems, having meetings, reading about leadership, that it does help make it possible to have such a shift as the civil rights movement had and the way it influenced other movements. So I just am encouraged by seeing children that are curious, but now that the adults will give them more direction in coming together and talking, how important it is coming together and talk, to just not just let the digital news updates of, are we in tariffs, are we not in tariffs, is it 25% or is it 90%? Forget the percents and look at, how can we work, what do we have, what strengths do we have if we unite and we plan.
Great. And that brings us nicely towards our conclusion. I think we'll do one last piece of music.
Yes, this last song that we're ending with, We Shall Overcome, ties together the beginning of Dr. King's work with the Montgomery boycott. It's a song sung as people were marching and picketing. It's sung by a lot of groups who connected it to their movement or issues. So we're going to hear, and you could stand wherever you are and sing, We Shall Overcome.
Thank you.
was We Shall Overcome. The ringing, resonating, lasting message of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., whose tragic passing by assassination we are remembering today on the anniversary, April 4th. Charlotte, do you have any final thoughts as we wrap up?
Just remembering and sharing Dr. King's words, the time is always right to do what is right. Thank you for joining us today to honor Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.
Yeah, thanks for putting this together, Charlotte. It's been great to sit with you and hear these speeches again and talk about them and hear your own direct personal experience with some of that has been really great. And, you know, you said the time is always right to do what is right. And here, the time was always right for love time, poem time.
Right. When people ask me what time it is, I always say it's time for love time, poem time.
Love time, poem time, love time,